This podcast is brought to you by Upcase. Improve your development skills by completing coding exercises that are peer-reviewed by real humans. Learn more at upcase.com.
Hey everybody, this is Mark in San Francisco. Gordon is out for the next 2 weeks, so today we have a very special guest, one Mr. Keith Smiley, an iOS developer here in San Francisco. Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, how's it going?
Fine.
So Gordon is turning 30. He turned 30 yesterday, the big 3-0. So he's taking 2 weeks to go home to the motherland of Texas, and taking these headphones off, I can hear myself. And he's going to get presumably very, very drunk on Shiner and eat a whole mess of barbecue. And if you're not from Texas, a whole mess of means a very large amount of.
I hear they have spicy stuff there.
I think so. I don't know that's true. I've never actually been.
I feel like Gordon said something about a store where you bought sauces that were very hot at some point in his hometown.
Oh, right. Yes. And if I recall correctly, there's a brewery where you can get beer and you can take the beer to go.
Ah, that's a good time.
And like walk around downtown Fredericksburg, I want to say, and drink your beer.
This is definitely something San Francisco needs. Walk around, drink beer, not get arrested.
I'm surprised we don't have that. Because you can walk around and do just about anything else and not get arrested.
And actually, people do walk around and drink whatever they want and not get arrested. So I guess that should be fine.
Well, you can put anything in a brown bag, right? As long as it's like in a brown bag.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Well, like when you buy like a 40 at the liquor store on your way home from work.
It's just a common occurrence.
If you do, it's the royal you. They ask you if you want like a brown bag because it's like implied like you're going to open this thing and you're going to drink it and get bent on your walk home. So I think that's allowed.
I don't think that's legal. I think that the people just pretend like you're not doing it.
Oh.
I'm sorry to ruin that for you.
So it's effectively illegal.
Yes.
Okay. I can live with that.
According to The Wire, that is how that happened.
I need to watch this show.
That's like actually a scene where they talk about that. And the police chief is trying to justify legalizing drugs in a certain part of the city. And he's saying, well, this is what the cops did in the 40s. They just started not arresting people using brown bags. And so we're going to do that same thing now, except by letting people do heroin in this area. You should watch The Wire. It's good.
I will watch The Wire. But I do want to say that alcohol and heroin are very, very different.
Yeah. I wasn't trying to say otherwise.
Okay. So we should probably not talk about baseball.
Well, you are wearing a Giants shirt, so that's kind of difficult. I'm not. I am a Cubs fan, speaking of the last episode of the show.
Oh. So do you have things to say about...
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, that's not what we were hoping for. Yeah, we were hoping for someone that would have very strong opinions about the Cubs.
Nope. I don't pay enough attention off-season to have a strong opinion. But if I did, I would share it with you.
Good talk.
Thanks.
Well, we got John Lester. Okay, no, we should not talk about this. All right. So what have you been working on?
I have been working on a Mac app that does some stuff, uses some Reactive Cocoa, stuff like that.
Are you ready to talk about what it does, or are we waiting?
I don't know. I don't really care if we do, so I guess so, yeah. So the Mac app pulls for pull requests on GitHub. That is a complicated sentence. And gives you notifications, like OS X notifications, when there is a new pull request to a repository that you're subscribed to in this application. I guess our initial thought with it was we had a few of us working on, or like you and me, working on a different application. And we were wondering, or not wondering, but, you know, we cared when the other person submitted a pull request, right? So, you know, you'd maybe get that email depending on how your email stuff is set up. I don't get emails from new pull requests, but maybe you'd get a GitHub notification, but a lot of people's GitHub notifications are like overwhelmed with tons of crap. So we were thinking that it might be useful to get a push notification for these pull requests, right?
Right.
So, yeah, I don't know. We built that. I don't know. It works at this point. We're kind of putting some final touches on it and stuff like that.
I know for me that I check email exactly twice a day. In the morning when I get in. Yeah. You seem shocked by that.
Yeah.
it's too distracting to have open during the day because it completely derails me. It's like, oh, this sales thing just happened, or, you know, something else is going on. And I'm a very highly distractible person. So I do just confine it to, I come in the morning, like the first 30 minutes, drinking coffee, like catching up on email, trying to get to inbox zero, quit mail for the rest of the day. And then the last hour, or if I'm really in the zone, I'll just leave and like finish doing email on the bus home. So I just don't have it open. And if someone wants a PR review, like they're going to have to like dump it in a room in Slack and ping me, or God forbid, use the at channel and ping everyone, to like review this thing. And like, that's less than ideal because I can't really opt out of those. But at least with this app, you can just select the repos that you want to watch and just start getting regular, you know, notification center notifications for them. Click on it, open the diff in Safari. Does it go straight to the diff?
No, it doesn't. We could think about that. That would actually be interesting. I don't know. It depends on how people use the description, though, right? Because if you write a meaningful description in the pull request, which we sometimes do, depending on what we're doing, then I would probably want to read that first before I read the diff. So I think it's just reasonable to go there. I think that's what I expect from that. I don't know. I mean, in theory, we could add like a button or something that sent you straight to the diff instead of where it went now. But
can you add those multiple buttons to the notification thing, or is that a private API?
Yeah, no, you can add at least like two buttons that do different things. I'm not sure if you can. You definitely can't do everything. We talked about before here how you can't hook into the same notification images that iTunes does, where it has the album art on the left and then it has the iTunes icon like slightly smaller to the right of that. And we can't do that. So we're right now showing the user who submitted the pull request, we're showing their image on the right-hand side because we can put an image there. And the left-hand side is forced to be the application icon. And iTunes kind of goes around that by using this like private property on NS user notification to set that image, which looks a lot nicer. But we can't do that.
So it's a very tiny app icon, like just to the left of the title.
Yes.
Of the notification.
Yep. And that makes a lot of sense for ours because the application icon is totally secondary to what you're trying to pay attention to. Like, we want to show the user image because that is the useful piece of information, especially for the stuff that we're working on where it's like, okay, you know, Mark submitted this pull request or whatever. But now we just have two giant images, which takes up a huge amount of space on the notification and like cuts off the title of the PR and the repo title and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which is kind of weird. But I'm not sure if we can do what Calendar does, where it has two buttons and one of them is a snooze, and when you click on the snooze it shows in like an NS menu that has a few options. I'm not sure if we can do that or not, but we might be able to. I think there's just like a respond to button click delegate method or something like that, or like activated.
Does having a right image on the notification preclude you from having those options?
I bet you lose even more space and it pushes the right image to the left, right? Yeah, it looks really bad.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Kind of as a quick aside, there is still a bug in Notification Center where if you have Notification Center open and you get a notification and then you click that notification, Notification Center closes and it takes you to whatever action. But every notification after that comes onto the screen as if Notification Center is open. So it like starts like, I don't know, like a sixth of the width of the screen in. And like animates even further. It's like right in the center of like Xcode, like while I'm trying to write code, just
that's
like
terrible.
Sitting there staring at me and like vanishes out the same way. But that's neither here nor there. Just everything's terrible on the Mac.
I have submitted a surprising number of radars while we've been working on this project, way more than I submitted on an iOS project. And Diana asked me about that the other day, just because I like submitted like three radars before lunch one day. And I just feel like, a lot of the stuff on the Mac, it just annoys you more because you could get around it or you could fix it if it weren't for sandboxing, where like you just wouldn't even have that option on iOS, so you wouldn't even care, right? Like I can set value for key to fix that image problem to make it work with the iTunes one by like setting the value of the image for the key of like underscore content image or something like that. But obviously we couldn't do that and then put it in the Mac App Store. Mm. And that annoys me way more than something we could just not do on iOS at all. Right, because you have the alternative method of like, you know, distributing outside of the Mac App Store.
What's the biggest advantage to distributing in the Mac App Store then?
Well, I feel like there are a lot of advantages. you know, it's easier, or in theory, you know, users could find stuff by searching for stuff, right? Like, I don't know. I haven't searched in the Mac App Store for a while for just like GitHub, but I imagine that it wouldn't be too difficult to be high up in the search results for just GitHub, which I feel like would be useful if people wanted to do that. We don't have to deal with like licensing or any of that kind of stuff if we wanted to sell it and stuff like that. And overall, I think sandboxing is nice because it doesn't really make any sense that an application that like, you know, listens for pull requests and then shows notifications should have access to my file system, right? Like, why do you have access to my music folder? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not really a big deal if the application isn't doing anything nefarious, but I get why sandboxing is nice. It can just be super limiting sometimes. Like the login item stuff we were talking about, where there are two different login item APIs, like to get the application to launch at login. And the one that's not sandboxed is super easy, and it makes the application show up in system preferences under users and groups under your login items. And the sandbox one doesn't show up there. And that's by design. There's some Apple documentation somewhere that says that that's intentional. But I think that's way worse, because that means like if you want to remove a login item or even see the... There's no way to see the login items that you have from sandboxed applications. So if you want to remove them, you have to know that they're happening, which you may not, depending on whether or not the like application that has a menu bar icon or a dock icon. And then to disable it, you have to open the preferences of that application and find out, you know, find a checkbox or something and remove it. Whereas with the non-sandbox ones, you just go into system preferences and like hit minus and it's gone. Yeah.
Is there some app store requirement that if you do have a login item using this sandbox API that you have to provide an option to remove it?
Yes. But, well, kind of. You can't enable it by default or you'll get rejected. So, which makes sense. I'm okay with that. But I guess that in theory, if someone enabled it and then, like, if you allowed a user to enable it with a button and then you just didn't show a way to disable it, that might actually work. I don't know how that would happen, but... just kind of unfortunate.
Are you doing that in this app?
Yes. So this app has a checkbox in the like advanced preferences that lets you launch a login, which I think is ideal for this application. We really didn't want to have to deal with that because of the crappier API. And we ended up just using some third-party thing for it that isn't really well-maintained. Oh, and I guess actually that API is deprecated in 10.10 and it doesn't have a replacement. So that's kind of frightening too. So we talked about not doing that, but it seems like kind of a core feature. And I talked about this with Gordon and he said, you know, why don't you just let me add it as a login item? Like, because you can do that in system preferences. But I feel like it's too important to expect users to do that because mm-hmm. that is kind of complicated. I mean, you have to go through a few steps or whatever.
Yeah. It's not one of those apps that you really use. So when you restart your Mac, you're not going to think, oh, hey, I need to open up this app, otherwise I'm not going to get pull request notifications. It's just something that sort of runs and you take for granted. So right. you really want it just automatically launching when Mac OS X launches.
Yeah, totally.
So that sucks.
Yeah.
Is this a common thing where they like deprecate APIs and then just don't provide replacements? Or is this just like things are awful?
I think it's just the latter. Things are unfortunate. But, I mean, I think they do this occasionally, but especially around the login APIs, like a lot changed and I don't know why. And then there's not clear documentation on, you know, how to get around it. And like I said, like this is deprecated in 10.10 with no replacement and no comments about why it's deprecated. There's like some threads on the developer forums that don't explain, like the people are asking and have no responses and stuff like that. And
when you check that box to add it to the login items, does it have to prompt? Like, does the system have to prompt the user to allow it or anything? And
no, it doesn't.
You don't get one of those dialogues that...
No, I think that would make sense if it did that. Like, you know, they changed the dialogue in 10.10 for browser defaults, right? So if a different browser asks for to be the default, there's now, even if there's still an in-browser dialogue, there is a system dialogue that says, do you want to switch your default browser? And it's like, use Google Chrome, or the cancel button is like, use Safari or whatever. I wouldn't be surprised if they added something like that for it. I'd be okay with that. You know, I'd much rather know that that stuff on my system is launching at login, which is why I'm annoyed that that list doesn't include sandboxed things. And I was actually using the API to look at what other stuff was launching on my computer, and there was some stuff that like I definitely didn't expect. Like, I think Slack had something that was login. I don't know.
So this app, you also have a helper app, right?
Right, which is what you have to do to get the launch it login stuff to work. So
okay.
The helper app is actually what launches at login, and then all that helper app does is launch your main application. And it's really gnarly code, and even the example from Apple or the documentation from Apple says to do this, but the helper app just kind of it has to live in your application's resources, and then it kind of has to traverse up the directory tree to get to your application's executable, and then it launches that. So in the code for our helper application, there's like string by deleting path component 5 times. So it gets itself, it's like its own executable path, and then does that to get all the way up to your main application's executable, and that's it. And even worse, all of this is happening in main.m.
Why?
Like, I don't know.
Why do you need the helper app?
I don't know technically why. I mean, you're definitely required to do it. Like, the thing that launches at login has to be in a specific directory inside of your applications bundle. Like, the documentation has the place where it has to be. It has to be in, like, contents/login items or something. And that's the only stuff that can register with that API, I guess. Unless you register with, like, launchd specifically. But at that point, you have to have root privileges anyways. So I don't know.
Does this mean that you can make me an app that will show me all the things that are launching at login that aren't in the login items? Because I would use that app.
Yes, I did do this, and I put it on GitHub. I don't think it's... So you can't remove this stuff, but you can at least see it.
Yeah.
Right now, in theory, I could make you be able to remove it, but yes.
Well, how would I remove it manually?
You wouldn't. I guess you'd go to the preferences of the application, in theory, and then uncheck whatever place they had for that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Mac apps.
I didn't know you actually did that. We'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Okay.
We'll make that a thing that like everyone should have on their machine.
Yeah. I thought about trying to make that a better manager for that so that it was kind of equivalent to the system preferences manager. Like you could show the app icon and it shows like the app name now or the bundle identifier, which it might not have an app name if it's like something you added manually through launchd. If you add login items that are like bash scripts or something, which I have for like I use Mutt, so offline IMAP like runs through a launchd thing, so it starts on login, and so that doesn't have an app name obviously because that's just like pointing to a bash script somewhere in my home directory or whatever. But yeah, and I'm pretty sure you could implement removing of those with the correct API, which would be I think nice.
You've been developing Mac apps for a while, right?
A few years.
Did you do an iOS app first or a Mac app first?
Mac apps first. Yeah. I mean, I guess I did Mac apps before iOS was, or like iPhones were released at all, and then definitely before the SDK, obviously. But I was doing Mac apps when it was, because I grew up with Macs, so it was like kind of odd actually at the time though, but I was doing Mac apps of just like, I want to make this little helper thing, probably a lot of stuff that I could have done with like a bash script instead, but I didn't know anything about the shell at that point because I was like, you know, pretty young and didn't really know a lot about computers, so I could like, but I could drag stuff out in Interface Builder and like make buttons work.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I did Mac apps for a while like that before iOS.
That was my experience. I think in 2007, I bought like the Aaron Hillgass like Mac development book. And well, so at this point, I don't even think I was on Leopard yet, still on Tiger.
When operating systems were $130 for the upgrades.
Yes, and very, very stable.
Yeah.
And very pleasing to use.
Oh, how things change.
Okay, that's a dig. That's kind of a dig. I don't think it wasn't Project Builder yet then. It was still Xcode, but this is back in the day when Interface Builder was still its own app.
Yeah.
And like I can say that like I used Interface Builder as its own app, and that's like a badge of pride.
Yeah.
I should get that on a shirt.
That was relatively early for me, but I feel like now I still hear people say, well, I still hear like Daniel Jowkett say that he has builds that he builds for like super old versions of Mars Edit that he needs to build in like Xcode 3 still.
Whoa.
Or that was Xcode 3, right?
Yeah.
And I definitely see how that was way more confusing. And now in retrospect, that was way more confusing than having an all-in-one application, right? Because like you double-clicked on that file and like opened a separate app and you said like you had no idea what was going on. It's much better to be in one giant or, you know, yeah, I guess you can argue about whether or not Xcode is better, but...
It's shocking how mind-blowing it was when they integrated the two. I think it was like WWDC 2010, maybe 2009, when basically it was Xcode 4.
Right.
And they did the thing where, you know, it's like they have Interface Builder open in the left pane, and the code open in the right, and they click drag from like a view object into the code and like create an outlet or like create an action. And it was like the most mind-blowing thing you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah, I feel like that would be really hard to explain to like some of our like designers who are interested in iOS, and we're kind of working with them occasionally, and they've been going through some classes where they're like learning how to use Interface Builder to make animations and prototypes and stuff like that. And I think it'd be really weird to tell them like, okay, well now you open this other app to do the UI stuff, but then you're like kind of integrating these two applications because the code's over here and you're attaching it to that. I think that'd be a really weird thing to explain.
Yeah, you're drawing connections between things in Interface Builder, and then like the menu that the tutorial is telling you should appear like appears, but the thing you want in there is not in there because you didn't decorate that property or that iBar, that like raw iBar, like in the interface block, like with IB outlet. So of course it doesn't show up.
Right.
And then you have all this crap on iPhone that like you really don't ever really care about, like the placeholders for like first responder, like cluttering things up, files owner. Like, do you even see anything anymore that even says files owner? Like, I don't even think that's a thing.
Yeah, I feel like that's a different part on the Mac because at least occasionally you have to deal with that stuff, like the NS application stuff, because you have to set menus and things like that. I'm pretty sure that's how you set the dock icon menu. So when you right click on the dock icon, it has like the normal system items like quit and keep and dock and stuff, but then you can add more items on that dock, and so you need to set that somewhere in there. So I think I like made an outlet between that and the NS menu.
I always forget that's there, that like apps can configure that dock menu thing. I sort of stumbled upon that the other day when Messages was having one of those days where it had the badge, but there were like no actual unread messages as far as I could tell from like the main window or the main interface. And I just happened to right click on it, and it puts the unread conversations at the top of that menu, and clicking them from there actually seems to make the badge decrement.
Oh, interesting.
And that's like the first time I've ever been able to fix that without like rebooting my computer.
Wow.
So that's fun. Pro tip. That may work for you. I'm not going to guarantee anything.
That's interesting.
That might work.
Well, in our application, at least, we had to add that menu because we have a menu bar icon or a dock icon or both or neither, right? So we needed you to be able to get to like the preferences from kind of anywhere. Mm. I guess if you have a dock icon, you'll have the main menu, so at least you could get to it from there. But it seemed nice to have that preferences window from there as well, so... If you were hiding the menu bar icon for some reason, because you...
What was the reasoning for having like those four possible states? Was it just to please everyone?
Well, so I think that the default is that there's no dock icon and there's a menu bar icon, and I think that's kind of the ideal state. So it just kind of sits up there, and then you get notifications. But someone who works at ThoughtBot asked for being able to hide that because they don't like having stuff in their menu bar, but they also didn't want it in their dock, which I totally understand. So we needed to allow like hiding it from both. And that's when we implemented that. And now if you like open the application when it's already running, it shows the preferences. So that's the only way you can get to it, which makes sense, I think, for people who want that. And I think that we eventually decided if you're doing that kind of thing, you're just saying, I know what I'm doing. I'm going to open this from here. And if you can't figure that out, I'm sorry that you chose to hide both those icons.
Yeah. And worst case scenario, you can always command tab switch.
Well, only if it's showing the dock icon. Right. And that's the weird part of that.
Right.
So if you hide the dock and menu bar icon, the only way that you can see the preferences is by reopening the application, even though it's already running. So you kind of need to know that. But we are assuming that people won't hide both of those things unless they understand that kind of action, which a lot of applications do. Like if you, Alfred does that, if you hide both of those things, like, I don't know, other applications that hide all the icons like that do that too. So I don't think that's too crazy.
I've never had a problem with that with Alfred because it's expected that there's some keyboard shortcut to focus the window. And then worst case scenario, there's always the gear in the bottom right corner and you can like get to any of that.
Right.
That's not too bad. So we started using Reactive Cocoa at about the same time. And like, this has been like a huge thing for me.
Yeah, I'm so happy that Diana and I can claim that we did this first because we introduced it into that Mac app. When we had a weird case, I guess. It was, we have a ton of repos that you're subscribed to, right? And we wanted to get the most recent pull request from all of them. And then we cared when all of those were done. And we were like, you know, this is, seems like a good time for us to try out Reactive Coca and see how it goes. And we wrote it in like, you know, 10 lines of Reactive Coca. And we were like, this is fantastic. And we were using, oh, we were doing some KVO stuff at the same time. So we were like, hey, let's, you know, throw their API on KVO and see how that works. And that was great. And then later we decided we wanted the user images too, which made a really complicated chain of things because you needed the most recent pull request from every single repository. And then if you were going to show that that pull request based on how old it was and you know, whether or not it was you who submitted it, we needed to download the user image. And all we cared about was when all of that was done. But as each network request is done, we needed to do some stuff. And Reactive Coca is perfect for that. And even trying to think that through with NS operations and like throwing that all in a queue and dependent operations would be really complicated.
You had a bunch of operations to do. At the end of each one of those, you had to do some side effect. And then when they all completed, you had to do some other thing.
Yes. And then it even got more complicated with the user images, right? Because then after each one of the initial ones was done, we had to take the output from that, get the user image from it, and then go download that user image. And then after we added those, we don't care about until all of those network requests and all the user image downloads are done, right? So we needed to like aggregate all of that into one thing that you cared about. And that's, I think, the craziest part for NS operations, because you can make operations that, you know, had a completion block where you saved it or whatever, and then, you know, you can make one operation that was dependent on all your initial ones, but then we would have to add more dependent operations as the original ones completed, which I think would have been pretty complicated to do. Right, because if we had an original operation that had dependencies on 10 operations, and then as each one of those finished, we had to add another dependency to that original one so that it still wouldn't complete, like, who knew about what would get really complicated there?
Yep.
But we could do that in Reactive Coca, like, really easily. So we get the repositories you're subscribed to. We map over those and create a sequence of signals, right? And each of those signals is, like, get the most recent pull request. And then we kind of merge all those together, and we subscribe Nixt on that in Reactive Coca. So we get the JSON from each one of those in a block, right? And so on that JSON, we kind of like put it in core data, and we kind of mess around with it a little bit. And then kind of towards the end of that, we integrate a new signal that from that JSON takes the avatar URL from the user. So we like flat map that into that array of signals, or into those merge signals. So now you've added even more signals to that. And then we have just a single completed block that grabs all of the newest ones based on some predicates from core data and then shows them.
What's your experience been like working with core data and Reactive Coca? I'm pushing a button.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely not as great as using Reactive Coca by itself, right? Like we have two projects going on right now, the one you're working on most of the time, the one that I'm working on most of the time, and we're using Reactive Coca in both. And I think that the Reactive Coca in yours, which isn't using core data, is a lot cleaner. And I mean, obviously the people at GitHub have some like thoughts on core data, right? So it makes sense that Reactive Coca doesn't work as well with it, because I mean, I think that their big use case too is GitHub for Mac, right? So, and I don't know how much they're persisting in there or how they're persisting it, but I'm pretty sure they're not using core data to do that, because they're using Mantle, which also doesn't really work that well with core data, because you have to make objects that are subclasses of MTL model. Mm-hmm. And not NS managed object, right? So you'd have to have two model objects for each one of your model objects to make that work, which is why I've normally used the easy mapping library for that,
right,
too. But yeah, I mean, it's gotten a little bit weird because of blocks, right? So inside of one of your subscribe Nixt blocks from Reactive Coca, you have to do some stuff from core data and then return some stuff too. So if we want to do that on a background queue, we kind of have to like make a block variable and then do a perform block on whatever context you're using and do the stuff and then return that so that it keeps going through the Reactive Coca chain, mm-hmm, which is kind of strange.
Yeah. The like one benefit to Reactive Coca is that you can like parallelize stuff and put stuff in the background. You never really have to worry too much about where things are happening or threading issues. until really the end of your chain, until it, you know, until it's sending next or it's sending error or it's sending completed. And at that point, you'll just say, okay, deliver on main thread. Like, you know, I'm wrapping a network request in Reactive Cocoa and I'm creating a signal and I'm doing this thing and I'm sending completed. And at the very end, deliver on main thread. Done. Like, it happens on wherever Reactive Cocoa wants it to happen, but finally it gets funneled back into the main thread. But because of CoreData's questionable concurrency APIs, where you have to dispatch things on this private queue that you don't have access to, and because Reactive Cocoa is so easy to use with threads, like, you don't really know or have to care too much about what's going on over there either. Like, it's hard to reconcile the two. Like, at the very least, like, if a context could vend its queue, like, this is my private queue, I think you could at least make some rack scheduler that just happens to also run on that queue, and then you'd be fine. But that is not possible because it does not publicize its queue. So it's kind of a mess. I think the solution there would be, like, you'd have to do the thing you were just talking about and end up with, like, intermediate data objects that then later, completely separate, get, like, put into core data, which I don't think is super crazy. There is, like, sort of precedent for that. And it, and the advantage is that it keeps your persistence completely separated from, well, everything else, just plain old objects. But, yeah, like, I saw some of the pull requests coming through, and I'm like, this sucks, but there's nothing we can do about it. So perform blocks everywhere. Yeah.
I think that the most annoying part about that was that it wasn't obvious that it was an issue until you turned on the concurrency debugging flag that was introduced in the last year or two. And then it was like, hey, everything you're doing is wrong, right? But everything works fine. It just happens to be totally wrong. And so that kind of, like, got it, it took us from having code that looked pretty nice and worked, but wasn't obeying the core data laws, to looking really terrible and doing the exact same thing, but making core data happy. Mm-hmm. That was the part that was the worst there. And I know we looked at the, there's some reactive core data library out there on GitHub that we kind of looked at, and but it didn't seem like it would help that a lot. And it was relying on using the confinement model of contexts to function at all.
Yeah, which is what I was just going to recommend, right? Even though Apple recommends not using them anymore.
Right. And the documentation is really down on that. It's like, you know, this is the default for, you know, backwards compatibility, but you really shouldn't use it anymore, which is fine. And it makes a lot of sense within the scope of those APIs. But, you know, I ended up making a signal that just performed whatever a block you gave it and then saved. So it kind of wrapped that up in a nice way by you just return something from inside that signal. It would, like, give you the context inside of that, and you could kind of do whatever you want with it. And then that created signal would save and either, like, you know, send an error or send completed or send a nixed of whatever was happening.
Right.
And that still looked okay, but it wasn't. I mean, it's definitely not great.
The reactive core data thing looked good. I just kind of have misgivings about its stability. That's right. Nothing to say about its author or anything. It's just that, like, it's a third-party dependency that's built on another third-party dependency, and that always just, like, gives me pause. Like,
yeah, I mean, that's always been the thing that's kind of been questionable about using Reactive Cocoa in the first place, right? It was like, why should we introduce this big dependency that entirely changes our architecture when, especially as consultants, like, we're going to hand this off to somebody and they're not going to understand how this library works? Because, you know, a lot, I'm sure there are plenty of iOS developers, including myself until like a week ago, who never used Reactive Cocoa, right? So that's a kind of a big deal for us.
Yeah, that does kind of box us in. Like, I still probably wouldn't pull in Reactive Cocoa into a client project. And at this point, I'm, like, so in love with it that it's going to be bad. Like, I'm going to be angry for a little bit, like, that I can't use it. Luckily, I have some tricks up my sleeve as, like, a fallback to, like, kind of get close to keeping an app sane. But that's a huge bummer. Like, I've almost become too dependent on it. Like, I'm just way too in love with Reactive Cocoa. Like, right now, I'm just on this bender of, like, wrapping Apple's frameworks in reactive variants.
Yeah, do you want to talk about the location manager you've been working on?
Well, we've been recording for 36 minutes, and, like, I think I want to save that because I don't know what we're going to talk about next week.
Okay.
So I think I might have you back next week.
Okay.
And we'll continue talking about. Maybe I'll actually open source it by then.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think there's a lot of room still for good reactive Cocoa examples, because that's been a big part of our learning, right? Is there are a ton of ways to do things, and you're trying to figure out kind of the best way to do things. And especially when, like you said, you're interacting with Apple APIs, like how do you reconcile that into the rack world where this stuff doesn't happen the same way? I think you and Gordon had a really good point last week about, like, there are, you know, these different patterns in Apple's frameworks, and how does that translate to rack, right? And that's what you've been dealing with.
Yeah, I have lots of pointers there it's knowledge that has been hard won, but we'll share that next week. Especially trying to wrap up imperative delegation is quite difficult with Reactive Cocoa, but let's wrap this up. So the show notes for this episode will be available at buildphase.fm/71. As always, we'd like to hear from you, so email us at buildphase@thoughtbot.com or reach out on Twitter at buildphase. And as always, we appreciate ratings and reviews on iTunes. All right. Thanks, Keith.
Cool. Yeah, thanks.
All right. Later.